Blog Talk Radio.
JH Experience with co-host Dolly Miller Brennan.
Produced by CommunicationCreations.com.
And now your host, the notorious MJH.
Zombies ahead. Have you guys heard about that? People changing the road signs.
I can't believe
it. They're apparently breaking into these road signs, these construction road signs, breaking the locks off the box and changing the message to say, caution, zombies ahead. It's humorous, but the weird thing about it is it happened in Austin, Texas. It happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and now it's happened here in the Hampton Roads area. And you know, the freaky thing is this some kind of new trend, like some internet secret trend that, you know, it's just like the secret plot to change all the road signs. I don't know, because like these people break into the road signs and they can put anything they want to on these messages, but they put caution zombies in here, which is funny, but I think I'd be a little more creative. Y'all don't want to know, but if I had that kind of ability. Okay, we might have kind of a light listening audience tonight, because I just saw on my Twitter here that President Obama is speaking live at the 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's inauguration. He's live on WH.gov right now. So, yeah, we might have to split our audience tonight.
Well, for those that are watching him, I mean, that is an absolute crime that he would show up at the John F. Kennedy Center. I mean, he's the president.
So many people actually compared him to John F. Kennedy when he was first running, because they thought, well, it's kind of bad to say, but they thought he might get there might be assassination attempts on him. But I don't know. Also, when he was running, did you hear that the KKK actually supported this guy? Did you guys ever hear that rumor?
No.
Well, yeah, I actually looked into it, and what it came down to was they couldn't stand Hillary so much they actually backed Obama. True story. Yeah. All right, everybody. We're here tonight with Dolly Miller Brennan, our co-host, and Mr. Andrew Castanuela, running for senator from the great state of Texas in 2012. And tonight we're going to be talking about stereotypes in politics with an emphasis on ethnicity, economic class, and nationality. And the only question I have about this, are we talking about the stereotypes of the politicians, or are we talking about stereotypes of the American people? Because we don't really have a lot of stereotypes in pertaining to that in, like, public office. I mean, it's mostly white women or white men. We don't have a lot of beaners in there. That's why we're supporting you, Kath. We should be one of the first. But and I was also thinking about this today. There's really not a lot of Jewish politicians. I guess the jobs don't pay enough in public office. I'm not sure.
We had one in Texas, a representative in Texas, and they wanted him to resign because they wanted Christians in office. Is that correct?
Joe Strauss? Is that what you're talking
about?
Speaker of the House?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he is one. Actually, it kind of got nasty then, and it was really inappropriate, in my opinion, of how they wanted to bring race into issue in reference to that. And I don't think it was... I think that was just a more of a sect of individuals who were trying to do anything they can in politics and war, so to speak. And I just thought that was just very unprofessional and very disrespectful to, you know, kind of bring out the race card and try to play.
No matter which end it's on. I know one thing I found interesting was your views on the Electoral College. And the Electoral College, there's a lot of discussion about it.
Mm-hmm.
About whether you want it or whether you don't want it. And, of course, there are arguments for it, you know. It
does
contribute, I think, to the political stability of the nation. And it does encourage a two-party system. And one thing that it does, for me anyway, it contributes to the cohesiveness of the country by a popular vote. Please give us your opinions. In fact, what they're doing now, I think, is misusing the Electoral College, going into those highly populated areas to select that have a lot of electoral votes, and then taking those votes away from the heart of the country. You know, the heart of the country may vote for someone if they go into one area. Now, if we go to a popular vote, that's what we're going to have. Is that correct?
Well, no, you're actually, that's pretty correct, and it's unfortunate because that's how actually campaigning is really done. It doesn't make if it's at the local level, at the state level, or even at the federal level. I mean, they target specific counties with specific voter turnout, specific age demographics, and they're going to say, based upon this, this is how we're going to get elected. And when you put it at the federal level, such as, you know, President of the United States, you know, they're looking to see, one, which state I'm able to get the most electoral votes for, and then within that state, you're going to start breaking it up, just like if you're running for the U.S. Senate, and saying which cities or which demographic areas can I focus on that are going to vote more my way or the other way, and that's how the political process is done. Then again, at the flip side of that, like you said, if we go to the popular vote, then you say it's just straight across the board, you know, this person ends up winning the election. Actually, it kind of reminds me of the debate that's going on when the Constitution or our country was first being formed, in reference to how many electives should be represented from each state. Should it be based
right.
upon population, or should it be based upon, you know, the income of that country, or how it may be? And that's it continues to debate here. We are 200 plus years later, and having the same debate. And I think at this point I still support the Electoral College to some degree, because, you know, you do have, you know, some states are more populous than others, and it's almost done the same way when you elect the House of Representatives. You know, it's all based upon the population, and those that state that's more populated ends up getting more representation in Congress. Well, same thing, it's almost, well, it's identical almost to Electoral College. That state also is going to have more electoral votes to elect the President of the United States. But at the same time, you know, it's up to the American people whether they want to shift that or not, in reference to, and not so much the electoral process, but to shift to who they want to represent them in the White House or in the Congress or in the governor's office. You know, that's where really the pavement meets the road, and where the American people got to step up and say, okay, you know what, yeah, it may be electoral, it may be popular vote, but you know what, it's still my vote, and it's how I can get everybody to vote in that voting process.
I kind of think that in this day and age, with the technology we have today, I mean, because I think originally they went to the Electoral College to kind of like save time on counting the votes when they actually had to count them by hand, and you know, they had witnesses and everything else. And I think now that it's done by computer, I think I don't see where it would slow things down to have every vote in particular count.
Well, you know, not every state has been able, and that's actually probably one of the things, you know, the Federal Elections Commission can probably make a more of an impact in saying standardizing the voting process throughout the United States. But that ends up, that's a double-edged sword. One, you're having the federal government pretty much dictate to the states what they have to do and how they're going to do it. And on top of that, they have to fund that process and where they're going to get the funding for that process. On the flip side of that...
Excuse me, because I didn't realize. I thought all the states were computers now. At least with little pokers like they have on
the... Otherwise, you might end up disenfranchising some voters. And as Hamilton had said, I think it was Hamilton, that said that any power not specifically granted to the U.S., to the federal government, or any power not specifically granted to the U.S. government, or any power that the state did not oppose goes to the state. So the states have more power than... actually the federal government, but it's slowly moving in the other direction.
Well, I wouldn't say slowly. I think it drastically moved the other direction.
Well, you're right, drastically.
Between the past 10, 15 years. Actually, I would even go more than that, maybe 25 years. But and that's actually the 10th Amendment of the United States we're basically looking at. You know, any powers not granted to the federal government, and that's not specifically designated to the federal government, and it's not designated to the states, will automatically default to the states and the people. how the 10th Amendment reads. And that's you know, why you have the health care debate. You have all these challenges that are going on in regards to the federal government extending their authority into legislating outside of the Constitution.
Now, Kath, was not the choice between was this not a compromise, a Washington-Hamilton compromise, where you would allow the Congress to be chosen by the population, and they put one one population for all offices and one one so many per state? Did they not compromise to allow Congress to be elected one way and then give each state two senators? Was that not a compromise to the people?
Yeah, actually, that was what they called the Great Compromise, actually.
Right.
when they finally came down to the point of saying, okay, this is the way we're going to, one, going to establish our government as a bicameral legislation where we have two houses, and this is the way we're going to go ahead and elect these individuals and appoint these individuals. Because initially, the senators of the United States were never elected. They were actually appointed, you know,
exactly.
by the states themselves until the amendment got rewritten. And within the past, I can't remember what it was. I was trying to recall the American history, but then all of a sudden they started going to where the states started electing their senators, which I think is actually a great idea, to be honest with you. That was a great compromise that they ended up putting together, where they said, okay, this is how we're going to go ahead and do it, and this is, we're going to base it upon population, and we're going to base it upon, you know, representation, and we're going to base it upon, you know, having a two-cameral, two-house system with, you know, checks and balances and putting in, of course, the third branch, which was the judicial branch, you know, the Supreme Court, which was in there to pretty much balance the powers between the other two whenever you saw one party or one branch was exceeding their authority.
Now, how do you see the division of economic classes, Cass?
Well, and it's interesting because we look at economic classes and you know, it's commonly been portrayed that we have, I would say, three economic classes in the United States. I would venture to say we have six economic classes in the United States, and they range anywhere from the elitists, those that make over than $1 million over and above, and then you have the higher middle class, which is making anywhere from $250,000 up to $1 million. And then you have the middle class, which makes anywhere from $60,000 or $65,000 up to $250,000. And then from there you start going down to your lower middle class, your working class, and then your underclass. And your underclass is basically...
I agree with that completely, because I think there is just a real confusion. Everyone considers themselves middle class, but that actually isn't correct. And I like your analogy of the economic class structure. How do you think that's playing into, the stability of our country?
Well, that's unfortunate. Is it that right now the economic class system that we have set up is really kind of hurting our country, because there's a couple things that are contributing to that, and one of them has to do with the birth rate. If we look back to the history of time, each country has to have a certain amount of birth rates throughout each year to support itself through, you know, the coming years. You know, even when we look at the Roman Empire, you know, the birth rates they were going through. Currently, as it has been in the past 10, 15 years, is that the United States birth rate has been decreasing and decreasing, along with every other country in the world, minus China, who's already got 1 billion people. But even then, it has to have a certain amount of people to continue to sustain its services. Now, we're talking about the birth rate. We're talking about people who will eventually get into the working force, who are going to end up paying taxes. And these taxes are used to provide services, i.e. such as Medicare, Social Security, and everything else. And as we look at the economic class right now, we have a lot of people who are working in the upper middle class, making more money, and they're a higher age group, which are fixing to retire. And I think we like to call them the baby boomers, but we're not having enough of the working class and the lower middle class and as people that are going to help sustain that. Because
so
we don't
you,
have these to
you,
make the sandwiches.
I'm sorry?
Are you saying
somebody
that we're not
needs to
having,
make the sandwiches.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that we're not having, that the working class and the lower middle class are not able to raise themselves up due to the lack of economic development? Is that a consideration so that
well,
they are going
not,
to replace that?
was, I wouldn't say not so much on the prosperity perspective, although there was a lot of regulations that limited a lot of prosperity for both the middle, and I'm going to go ahead and generalize everything into three classes, and basically, for simplers, you got the upper class, the middle class, and the lower class, so to speak. I like to call the lower class a working class. But basically, is that because the prosperity is always going to be there, as long as people are given the opportunity for innovation and creation and entrepreneurship, which has been significantly difficult for those individuals throughout the past few years, or I say decades, because of regulations placed on these people to be innovative entrepreneurs and new businesses not to be started, new ideas not being created, and that's limited us to be able to compete on a world economy. At the same time, you're looking at a working class of the people who pay, you know, Social Security, even though they may get a refund at the end of the year because they don't pay that much in taxes, they're still paying into the Social Security system. We have not been having enough workers work in that field because, one, we started not having as many kids. And if we look at the birth rate, I think we're at about 2.1 per every household, when it takes at least two to continue to sustain its programs for future generations.
So
every
you're
other
saying we're paying out more. We've got more people that are becoming dependent
exactly.
than we have people that are paying into it.
And that's why illegal immigration becomes an issue. And actually, we need illegal immigration reform. We need it from the perspective of having these immigrants come in, because they're going to end up paying, as long as they do it through the legal process, they end up actually sustaining the economy, what we're deemed to happen to keep America competitive, because other countries are not, whether it's Germany, whether it's Italy, whether it's South Korea, other than India and China, and right now currently the United States, are only three countries that are pretty much sustaining its birth rate, and ours has only been sustained because of an influx of immigration.
That California said that the babies, the children of illegal immigrants, cost them $600 million last year. So this plays into what you're saying, is that there are more people dependent upon these funds and there are those generating them. Is that correct?
Well, that's part of the one equation. When you look at it, $600 million compared to, and that's just, let's just classify that, because, and I'm going to assume this as being $600 million in Medicaid, okay? And we're looking at it from that perspective. And I always kind of question these numbers, to be honest with you, because it's kind of difficult to track, especially if you can't ask what their residency is. You know, how do you
sure,
know this
it's
was...
just a general figure.
Yeah, and that might be where the stereotype comes into play. Well, based because you're Hispanic, or based because you're this, you and you're on Medicaid, you must be, you know, an illegal immigrant. And that's not always the case. But going back to the situation, is saying $600 million compared, you know, to $700 billion program, you know, is not a lot of money, although it is a lot of money for the state of California from that perspective. But it's more importantly is looking at, out of $600 million, how many of those people or their parents were working and either, one, paid Social Security tax under a false Social Security number, or could have paid Social Security tax.
That's a good point.
Or could have paid Social Security tax if they were here under legal visa, paying into the system looking for citizenship. You see, that's going right back into sustaining those baby boomers who are going to retire here and going to require Medicaid.
That's a good point.
And
what
that's
we
why
need to do is adopt Chinese orphans.
Well,
now, Cass, how do you see ethnicity and nationality? How do you see those playing into, you know, the economic classes and just our government in total?
Well, first of all, we have to take back, and this is either from not only from a government perspective, but even from a profit industry perspective, is we have to take a really good look at the demographic changes that are not just happening in the United States, but also happening throughout the world. If we're a world economy, if we're a global economy, then we have to take a look at all the demographic changes that are happening, more specifically within the United States, because as we, as an enterprise, and I'm going to look more on the business side of the house, as we look at an influx in demographics in certain situations, in certain ethnicities, that's going to affect our workforce. That's going to also affect our political outcome, because depending on what that demographic population decides to vote, it's going to weigh on what economic policies are developed or what political policies are developed. So looking at that from that perspective, as he's saying, all right, we got to take a look at our demographic profile. See, you know, we can look at Hispanics, okay, and you automatically think Hispanics as a stereotype is just anybody who may be of a certain color. But within that demographic profile or demographic Hispanics, there's divisions of different type of Hispanics. I mean,
yeah, you got the Beaners, you got the Wetbacks, you got the Spics.
Well, you're on a roll today, aren't you, Mike?
And it also, when we talk about ethnicity and nationality, can we also look at that in the context of how that plays into profitability factors?
Did you say profitability?
Profitability factors in regard to products. You know, different ethnicities, different nationalities are going to relate more to specific products.
Exactly.
Can that help us economically?
Well, yeah, exactly, because going back to understand, this goes from the business perspective. If you understand your demographics, if you understand the population you're trying to serve, and you're trying to create a product for that specific demographic population, whatever it may be, and demographics means not only by race or ethnicity, it also means by sex, it also means by age, and it can mean by, you know, so many other factors. You have to look at that population's disposable income, number one, to make a profit, because they're going to spend their money on what they need to have. Business is based upon the disposable income that population or demographic has. If you macro that out and look at it from the American perspective, it's okay, what is the disposable income of the American people? Well, you're going to have to look and see how much are they paying into the government, how much are they paying into local taxes, how much are they paying into gasoline, and then say, oh, guess what?
How much do they spend on the Xbox 360?
Exactly, and that would be disposable income. And that's, you know, where you end up start looking and say, okay, this is how much money the American people have to spend on luxury, so to speak, because they end up spending the rest of it on their necessities.
And do we look at necessities? Can we look at ethnicity and nationality in terms of necessities? Individuals perceive what is necessary to them to sustain a lifestyle. Can we see that as business objective?
Well, there's two things. There's a difference between, in my opinion, between ethnicity and nationality. Ethnicity would be basically somebody's cultures of
right.
origin that they may have. You know, it could be anything. And then you have nationality, which basically means, to what do they own their national allegiance to, such as an American, you know? And as we have immigrants coming in to the United States, the goal of any, in my opinion, the goal of immigration should be to assimilate these individuals into our nationality, which basically means...
Oh, this is beautiful.
What is our American way of life? You continue to have your ethnic beliefs, you continue to practice those ethnic beliefs, the religious beliefs, whatever it may be, but understand we are an American country, and this is our allegiance and our loyalty to. So that's the path, in my opinion, of immigration reform, is to get them to synergize themselves to what we believe in. Unfortunately, also at the same time, if we step back and we say, who is America and what is America, is probably very confusing for a lot of people right now, because they may view America as being, you know, greedy. They may view America as being, you know, more socialist. They may view America as being, you know, could be even racist, could be whatever it may be, you know. So we need to redefine our core values as Americans, which goes back to the things that, you know, you were reading about George Washington. You look back to the things of, you know, Ronald Reagan. You look at things even to John F. Kennedy. These things that define us as Americans, who we are and what we want represented to the world.
So what you're saying is that if we tend to, say, develop into, you know, looking at some, and we do have a lot of different ethnicities, a lot of different mm-hmm. cultures, and if we relate to each culture individually, are you saying that can cause a fractionalization? Retain your culture, but become American first, and then have your culture at home. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. And well, you can have it at home, and you can have it in your business, you can have it in your community,
right.
But it still ends up being the American nationality of what we want to adhere to, and that should honestly be the Constitution of the United States, you know, and the Declaration of Independence. Those are our foundation that define us who we are. You know, when we get away from that, that's when we end up getting into fractions and saying, well, no, it's my ethnicity, it's my individual rights that are more important than the greater good of our country. You know, and that's I think what's caused a lot of confusion with the, you
so
know.
So if I understand you right, what you're saying is that we need to, yes, have immigration reform, and that everybody needs to assimilate into the American culture keep your own culture, but become American and have a national unity. Otherwise, we have all of these individual nationalities, and there's no unit, no cohesiveness, and it's more difficult to sustain ourselves as a nation.
Exactly. I mean, it's just kind of like, you know, even as a Hispanic who's running on a Republican ticket, going back to stereotypes, you know, you know, I end up telling them, I said, you must understand something first and foremost is that I am an American before I am a Republican. Okay. My
so
country
funny,
first.
Do you realize that what you guys are describing is Philadelphia?
Philadelphia.
You guys are describing the city of Philadelphia. I don't know if either of you two have ever been there, but
oh, yeah.
I grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And Philadelphia, you have one block that's Italian, you have another block that's Polish, you have another block that's Irish, you have another block that's Jewish, and I can just go down the whole list. But I remember 1776, the bicentennial. Yeah, I'm dating myself, no big deal. I was like 7 years old. But you know what? I remember being out there, and everybody was out there. Black, white, Hispanic, Jewish, whatever.
But everybody was
everybody
American
who came over here on the banana boat in 1900-something was out there selling of the United States.
But you're saying
you
everybody
know?
Came together and was an American.
Every okay, you had you it's completely segregated up there, or it used to be. I don't think it is so much now. But everything was segregated up there, but not segregated as saying you guys stay in that neighborhood, you guys stay in that neighborhood. It's just how it was. You know, it's just everybody, you know, moved to one block if they were from, you know, if they're from a certain ethnic group, that's the block they moved to. Or actually, a neighborhood. It was more than a block. And I mean, like 9th Street, you know, that was all Italian. You could walk down, that was like Market Street. They have a Market Street, but there's no markets on it. You walk down 9th Street, and that's where everybody had everything out there for sale, the produce, the, you could walk down there, and they had ducks hanging upside down, and, you know, from strings. You could get whatever you wanted to, and they were all out there on the sidewalk. And, yeah, but, you know, but what I'm trying to say is, although it was segregated up there, nobody was racist. Racist meaning, you know, you don't like somebody because they're of a different race. Okay, everybody got along fine. You know, they might say, don't go in that neighborhood or don't go in that neighborhood because of the bad neighborhoods or something like that. Or, you know, don't associate with that person or that type of person. But, you know, it wasn't where, like, when I say segregation, I think everybody thinks of, well, we just had Martin Luther King Day, you know, this past Monday, we celebrated, I think his actual birthday was Saturday. But Martin Luther King, you know, in those days where the black people had to sit in the back of the bus and they couldn't drink from the same fountain, man, that's bullshit, man. I couldn't imagine living like that. And if I was a white guy back then, you know, I'd be like, look, man, this is bullshit. I'd be standing right behind Martin Luther King going, yeah, man. You know, but, you know, like in Philadelphia, everybody got along great. And you could walk through a neighborhood and not get robbed. It didn't matter if you were white or black or whatever. But, yeah, exactly. That's all what I'm saying. Even though everybody stuck to their own communities, everybody, it's a city. And everybody came together. And when we had the Bicentennial, the Liberty Bell, and, you know, all that other stuff, I dropped something in a time capsule along with, I don't know, hundreds of other people at least, that's supposed to be uncovered in 2076. I might be alive then. I'd only be 170 years old.
That's one of the reasons why Philadelphia was called the city of brotherly love was because...
Yes, sir, that's exactly right.
You know, Cass, I think Mike has brought up a good point here. In regard to, you're saying, nationalities and ethnicities, in regarding to each one allowed to have their own particular rights, then can you see that as contributing to the divisiveness of society? Retain your culture, but, for example, I have a friend that, you know, manager of a big gambling complex because, you know, I'm mixed blood. I'm Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some individuals up there. We were talking about something, and I so admired him. He said, you know, I don't care what happened 200 years ago. Get over it. It's done. I'm living today. I'm an American. And that's how I feel about it.
Well, and that's what makes us so special is that we're able to put, you know, our country ahead of it's our identity. That's who we are. You know, that's what defines us, and that's what we want the world to remember. There was a great point in time when, you know, the world would look at America and say, this is the beacon of light. This is the country where, you know, you have the Constitution and the people have the power. And they have the ability to do and whatever they want, and that's why you continue to have immigration concerns, because people still want to come and believe that. But if we start losing that and becoming more of a country of divisiveness, in other words, the melting pot is no longer melting, and it's just starting to harden, and it's starting to harden because you have different sects of different ethnicities that are more important.
What you're saying is that if we have immigration reform and you are required to assimilate, you are required to learn the language, retain your culture, but you're required to be an American, it will start to decrease, hopefully, the divisiveness and increase national unity. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it can assist, but more importantly, it can also start looking at the fact, just even from the going back to the immigration perspective, is saying it brings in a workforce that's helping to sustain those programs that we develop that we really can't pay for, that we're already concerned about going bankrupt, whether that's Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid or whatever
exactly
it may be.
Right. Because there are people that paying Social Security under fake names, and they aren't paying into the system.
And you have people, and it goes back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. First and foremost, yes, they do want to believe they're Americans, but let's not be ignorant and say that the reason they really came here is because they wanted to feed their family. You know, they want to put food on the table. Same reason, you know, had Ellis Island. People wanted a better life because they wanted out of that poverty. You know,
that's what people told the great America.
That's
what
they claimed
out the bicentennial. And it is all about respect, by the way. I left that part out about Philadelphia. It's all about respect up there. You know, you don't matter if somebody's different than you. As long as you show them respect, they'll show you respect, vice versa. But, yeah, all these immigrants who came over here in the early 1900s, you know, wherever they came from, you know, whatever the story was, and everybody has a different one, you know. Mm-hmm. But whoever, you know, when they came here, this was the land of opportunity. This was the melting pot. This was where, you know, their dreams could come true.
And the issue
and
is to do it legally.
Yes.
Well, yeah,
yes.
Of course. And back then, it wasn't easy to become a United States citizen, you know, because, you know, like, you know, if they thought you weren't on the up and up, they could send you back. And these people knew it. And they became Americans when they got here. They were still Italians. They were still Polish. They were still, you know, whatever. Okay. But they became Americans when they got here, and they were they thank God every day that they were here, and they had the opportunity. And you know what? They never complained about working. They never complained about getting up and going to work. They thank God they were able to do it, and they go do it. And they don't complain about it.
And actually, they did complain, but at the same time, they were looking at it saying, but yet, this is a sacrifice I'm making for something that I want better than I had where I came from. Because, I mean, the working conditions weren't the greatest, and there was, you know, still some racism going on and stuff like that, but they still looked at it and said, let me put my issues aside and look for the greater good, which is the United States. Because
now, Cass, do you see in any way that ethnicity and nationality can have an effect upon the Electoral College, upon, you know, different areas, different regions supporting a different ethnicity, and that they could have an effect on the Electoral College?
Well, and to some would probably argue and say that it already does to a great degree, you know, whether you're in New York or even, I'll say, Milwaukee or Chicago or even Austin or even, you know, San Francisco, you know, the different ethnicities that populate those areas have a tendency to vote a certain direction, you know, and then based upon their outcome of their vote, whether it goes either one direction, either the Republican Party or it goes to the Democratic Party.
Now, do you see the Electoral College as needed to being revised, or do you see it if we need to keep it?
Well, and then again, you're looking at the Electoral College as being, you know, appointed by those individuals who end up winning that party in that process. So, it goes back to the party. The party is going to, you know, pretty much going to have their electorates vote for the way the party line wants them to vote. But
let's put it this way: if you were a white guy living in a black neighborhood during election 2008, your vote didn't count for nothing, because the black people who never thought about voting before were out there signing up and going to vote. So
okay.
you know the electoral thing. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it kind of works like that. You know.
So you're saying, Cass, that it's a check and balance.
Well, it to some great degree is a checks and balance, but and going back to answering your question whether ethnicity or nationality will play into Electoral College, I think it's going to start to reflect the demographics of our country, and more specifically the demographics within each specific area of our country, as each one of them gets populated differently. Because I mean, you really got to take into consideration. I know the spotlight is right now probably on Latino population, but when you're also looking at, you're still having, in comparison as far as voter turnout, so to speak, you're still having other ethnicities that are more apt to turn out for voting, such as, you know, Asian Americans, whether, you know, they're Chinese, Koreans, or Filipinos, or Taiwanese, and you're having an influx of Indians from India that are coming out as well, and they're going to be more active in the voting population, as you've also have, you know, within the, you know, the Eastern Bloc countries that come over here. So, you know, it's easy to focus on just Latino because it's the most rapidly growing.
Exactly. But as you said, it is it helps with the population, which brings another question to mind, I think, that you brought up. We're having a larger Muslim population that want their own laws, Sharia law, and so on. So we're seeing here a nationality that contributes to the divisiveness of the country. I can't even talk right now. So we're seeing that's divisive, and Mike's laughing at me in that respect. Okay, so we're seeing that... it perhaps that they are, again, you're saying immigrate, but you must assimilate. Immigrate and assimilate.
Exactly. That was the corner of our, in my opinion, of our immigration reform was, our immigration system was based upon the fact of saying, okay, you know, and I would even venture to say, you know, this is being very immature. Initially, when they started putting quotas on the number of immigrations, ethnicities are going to be coming into the country. They say, well, these have a tendency to vote a certain way, or these have a tendency to act a certain way. Let's put quotas on, you know, letting a certain amount of individuals in, you know, has affected that to some degree. But, yes, you know, it's important for them to, you know, to understand that regardless of, you know, your ethnicity, this is the United States of America. Keyword, united, where we have to be united.
Now, how do you see that as playing into language? Because in some areas you go into and English isn't spoken. You know, how do you see that contributing to the language? Of requiring everyone to assimilate and learn the language?
Well, that's probably one where, you know, it's one of those debatable things or controversial issues going on between an English-only language or English and Spanish, or people have to learn Spanish and so forth. And I'd rather punt that, actually, believe it or not, to the business industry. If the business industry wants to feel like they need to market their products or services to a specific demographic population for them to make a certain profit, then so be it. But I do not believe that the United States should end up supporting, you know, one language or another and saying this is our national language, or forcing somebody else to have to assimilate to that as well. In other words, when we starting to teach, you know, more Spanish in schools and stuff along those lines, so that, you know, they can get, kids can kind of get caught up and stuff like that.
Right. You're saying that should there be one language that creates the cohesiveness that everybody knows and then offer the other languages?
English.
And traditionally, the English language
universally
right now, the English language is the most common language spoken in the United States, you know, and that would be, you know, that's the language if you wanted to, you know, move up, and that's the way it is. I mean, and that's actually also going to be driven by our economic system. You know, if you're going to go work for a company and everybody in that company speaks English and you want to move up in that company, well, guess what you're going to have to learn? English.
Yeah. Down at the city the other day, I had to renew one of my permits, and I'm down at the city, and there's this application you have to, you know, it's like you got to swear to it and stuff like that, and it's like I'm over 18 years old, blah 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 blah. Number four, I understand English. I can read and write English. And I was thinking, well, if I couldn't read and write English, I wouldn't be able to read that question. And I was about to go to the guy. Excuse me, sir. What does this say?
So so what you're saying is, yes, you have one core language, but if the business community needs to adopt the different ethnicities and allow that language to allow them to catch up, but they need to be, actually it's a bonus to be able to use both of them at the same time.
Yeah, it's always bonus to be, you know, bilingual or trilingual or whatever it may be. I mean, heck, I'm trying to, you know, refurbish on my Japanese as well, but, you know.
I know, like Japanese. I'm working on my French.
Yet? When you go to a sushi restaurant?
Uh-huh.
I used to know how to say a couple of things in Taiwanese, but, you know, I was only repeating. I never understood the language. And they say that Chinese and, you know, the Asian languages are kind of easy, but they have so many different characters, and I don't know. It just seems really confusing to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what happened, I think lately, maybe, I don't think it's off topic, I don't think so, Facebook is a social network that really does help if you're practicing language. You know, like I speak French to a French friend, so, and she speaks English to me. We'll go back and forth, so it really helps both of us with our language skills. So sometimes even the social media networks can be helpful. First, you have to have the background in it first.
Well, you can go to Google Translate, and you can type in anything on Google Translate, and it's text and language, and it tells you what it says. And then if you want to answer them back, you can type in your message and hit convert from English to French and then send it. But I got to warn you about that Google Translate. You got to watch the grammar, because different languages have different grammar. And
oh,
I was talking to this girl in Croatia who spoke perfect English. You know, I could speak to her in English. But I wrote her something in Croatian just being funny, and it didn't come out the way I put it. And she explained to me that there's like five different layers of grammar in Croatian, you know, and the Croatian language and stuff like that.
Right, each language totally is amazing. Different. You really need the basic grammar before you can converse in it. I know when I was studying poli sci in Paris, let me tell you, I learned pretty quick. I thought I spoke French until I got there. And I got in the cab, and the guy went, I thought, holy shit, I'm in
trouble. Yeah, that happened to me one time. Well, I saw a guy from North Korea, you know, and I said, Yonghunseyo, which just means how you doing. And he did a dance in the street. Hey, Cass, hit channel. Hit channel on your phone. I know
what you're doing. Okay, Cass, so we're talking about the Electoral College, and I know that I think that's something that you are versed in, and something you believe has an effect upon us and how it's been changing. So if my understanding is correct, you want to keep the Electoral College. You may need some reforming, but it's a check and a balance on the population vote. To disallow someone from just concentrating on specific areas and getting the vote in and electing someone. Is that correct, that the Electoral College would be able to coordinate that, to be able to, if, say, someone did target particular areas and left everything else out, they'd be able to understand that, take that into consideration, and really reach an accurate decision? Is that correct?
Well, I'll be honest, when we come to Electoral College, because, can you hear me?
Barely, man. You need your channel again.
Yeah, I just called you.
Get closer to your hands or your antenna or something, man. I know you're on your cordless. I can tell.
But
it sounds like you're talking on a Radio Shack walkie-talkie from like 1972 or something.
It's the big guy in the
over.
Sky.
Roger.
Okay, what did you say about the Electoral College, Cass?
Yeah, when it comes to Electoral College, because that mostly plays into the federal election or the president of the United States.
Right.
Then it's going to play more into the Congress or the state level. So that's
it
something.
Doesn't affect upon the president, such as Al Gore targeted L.A. and Miami and targeted those areas, and he targeted the highly populated areas.
Yes, I mean I think it's been said that in order for me to win the U.S. Senate, there's five counties I need to focus on in order to get that done, because it's the most populated. And I'm venturing to say, well, no, that's saying the other 250 counties don't count, or 249.
You're saying if you live out in Pecos or Wickett or Monahan, you don't count. I understand exactly what you're saying.
Exactly. And to me, and that's where, you know, it's going back to establishing the nationality, just like I would establish the nationality of Texas. You know, we're Texas, okay?
They're saying focus on Harris County.
You know, I'll focus on every county, to be honest with
exactly.
you.
Exactly, and I understand what you're saying. They're saying focus on Harris County and some of these counties. And
yep.
You could ignore everybody out in West Texas, but it would be a great disservice to those people also.
And not only a disservice, it's kind of like a disrespect to our political process.
Yeah.
You know, that's a very valid
that's
point.
That's true
it's
anywhere.
It's not just you're not respectful of the people, but it's not respectful to the political process also, which I think is a very good point. To be respectful of the political process means you're respectful of your country. And for those that try to manipulate the political process, are you saying that possibility they care about their own goals more than they care about those of the goals of the country?
Oh, Mo, I would venture to say that's what the American people are upset with, is that the electorates, being, i.e., the politicians who get elected, are more focused on getting elected than they are serving the people. You know, whenever I see something read in, you know, one of the Washington, D.C. areas, that, you know, talking about the Senate race here in the state of Texas, you know, it automatically saying, okay, so-and-so's already a self-made millionaire and got so much money, and they could do them, they could run their own campaign themselves, so they're pretty much a shoe-in for the Senate, and so-and-so can raise so much money or so many millions of dollars to run for the Senate. You know, it's now no longer about representation. It's about how much money you can raise to promote yourself, versus,
and that, you know, that is a really that is such an important issue. And when it comes to raising money in regard to those that finance their own elections, such as individuals that have, and almost everyone that finances their own election is not elected, because if you raise money on a grassroots level, it means you have grassroots support. If you don't bother to do that, you may not have enough support to be elected. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, that's the common understanding. But I'm going to go back and say we have to take a look at the playing field, how the political process is being played as of today. You know, traditionally that would be it, saying, okay, one, if you have grassroots contributions, you have grassroots movements, your viability would be stronger to compete against those who have the networks and the political process in place to support their campaign contributions. But with technology coming around, it levels the playing field where you can still promote yourself without having to spend, you know, millions of dollars, even hundreds of thousands of dollars. That you become competitive, because on election day, it doesn't make a difference where I contributed, you know, my $2,400 a year to a specific candidate, or I contributed nothing. I'm going to go vote, and that vote counts just as much as that person that contributed $2,400.
And I think the social networks have a role to play here, you know, in being able to get that message across to individuals without spending a lot of money. And there are ways to advertise, and there are ways to campaign without spending a lot of money. I mean, it can happen. It does happen.
Yes, it happens all the time. And that goes back to, you know, Thomas Friedman, when he said the world was flat. It was because of the technology, how it's leveled the playing field. You know, I can be here in my house, and I can put some on eBay, and somebody in you know, Indonesia could buy that from me, and I could send it to them, and I could make money off of that. Where before, I had to go through a whole process. I had to be a company in order to sell to somebody in Indonesia, you know, in order to make those contacts. No, the technology just leveled the whole playing field economically for the world, both industrial and third world.
So what you're saying is we are a global economy, whether we like it or not, but we still have to take care of our own economy. I think what you're saying is, in regard to immigration reform, yes, come into this country, use the process, but there is a requirement that you must assimilate. However, you can keep your own culture, and that own cultural ethnicity that aids in economic development, because different entrepreneurs and business people can target those particular areas and can create profit from that, while you're still assimilating, you're still adding to the cohesiveness of the country, and then you see the Electoral College is kind of a balance there, a balancing factor. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, it's a balancing for the President of the United States, and from that perspective of showing, you know, the election from that perspective. Yes, you're pretty much nailing it all down. From that perspective, the big key thing is, once again, is that I guess if I was to stress, even just for my campaign, is that it's all based on the concept of, one, we are Americans, we need to unify to change our way of government and the way it's been governed, and the only way to do that is take off the glasses that say I'm a Republican only or I'm a Democrat only. No, I'm an American first, and then I'm party second.
And then are you saying that, okay, that absolutely we are all Americans and that we need to assimilate? By that, I mean becoming Americans, look out for America first, and then everything, while take care of your ethnicity, you know, adhere to your own culture, but don't allow that to subtract you from becoming an American and part of the country. Are you saying that?
Yes,
and you're saying that each group, say you have your own culture, such as me. I'm Jewish American Indian, French Jew and American Indian. So if I only relate to being a Jew or I only relate to being an Indian, then actually I'm becoming divisive and I'm not assimilating into the culture. And if I expect to have certain rights because I'm a Jew or certain rights because I'm an Indian, then every other group has to have those rights. So you're saying that you have your own culture, but you don't have specific rights because of that culture. Is that correct?
Well, and that's, I think, what the argument is today, and it's kind of devise this more because I think we want more ethnicities to want have more protection under the Constitution or representation than others, and that's not the way the in my opinion how the Constitution establishes it. You know, as all as Americans, we're going to be treated as Americans. But if once we start breaking it down individually and saying, oh, this ethnicity deserves more representation or more publicity or more rights than somebody else, and that means somebody else is not being unequal. And unfortunately, that's been decided not only within our bureaucratic systems, but also within our judicial systems, our court systems, and the court rulings that, you know, Supreme Courts and appeal courts end up saying, look, no, this is what it is, and this is what it is, and this is my ruling, this is my interpretation of the Constitution.
So are you saying if we eliminate that need for special rights, we could actually begin to eliminate some of the animosity toward different cultures because everybody has the same rights? Is that correct?
Well, I think that the court systems themselves need to take a step back and refrain from ruling on deciding which individuals or which special programs or ethnicities deserve more protection under the Constitution other than others, because that's really what happens whenever you have a Supreme Court ruling or a judicial ruling. Is basically you're saying, this person, for instance, in the state of California, I was reading about one of the things saying that in the state of California, saying those illegal immigrants who went to school in California and graduated high school in California and went on to college, that they got the right, the court rules that they have the right to pay in-state tuition. Well, okay, that may sound fair for that population, but that doesn't sound fair to the American citizen who lives in Arizona who wants to go to school in California but has to pay out-of-state tuition. See, that's what I'm kind of coming down to, is when we start specifying.
So I see what you're saying. If the court specified that certain groups have specific rights, and you're saying, no, retain your culture, but don't have specific rights for specific groups, everybody has the same rights, I think perhaps we could eliminate some of the animosity towards each group and become more unified and have a better nation.
Exactly, because, I mean, as long as, and this goes back to American citizens. American citizens are here, are those who are American citizens, and they feel that their rights have been violated. Yes, they have every right to go to court and have every right for an individual or peers to rule on whether they have or have not been violated. And then that's about as far as you need to go. I mean, a jury of your peers decides otherwise. I mean, that's the one balancing act that American citizens have in the judicial system to throw the court system out of place. Because you can have a judge say, no, you got to go the other way. But if you have a jury, which is basically the American people saying, no, we rule this way, the judge really can't do anything.
You know, Cass, I think you're, and I'm sure Mike agrees, I think you're one dynamite candidate for Senate, because all I see in you is the fairness doctrine toward everybody and everywhere. And if we had more people like that in the Senate, I think hopefully we could change some rulings, because we are a nation of laws, and we could change that and have a more unified nation. And for people, and you're right, and it does require funds. There are a lot of things you can do for free, but it does require funds. And a senator, whether you're from Texas or Virginia or Wisconsin, you're still going to have opportunities for impact on legislation in other states all over the nation. So therefore, it's important for someone in Maine to also know what kind of a senator you have in Texas. So how can people contribute again to you? How can they support you? And they do not have to be a native of Texas.
Well,
or they don't
have
to live there.
You know, from the financial perspective, that's pretty much given across the board. They can just go onto my website and castforsenate.com. But more specifically, I think we're probably going to take a different strategy from this perspective. It's because, you know, you have a big political machine that's pretty much been established for quite some time that's going to want, you know, their candidate to be represented, to represent that party. And I guess the perspective I'm looking at is saying, okay, well, let me use technology. And that would be that anybody who's interested and believes in the kind of concepts and ideas that I am looking forward for this country and every American in this country, regardless of political affiliation, can just email me, and you go to my site, and you'll find my email address and say, hey, look, I know I don't got no money, which, you know, we are in a recession, and I don't believe really in giving campaigns because that's not what it's supposed to be about, but I do want to help you. Just email me, and we'll get this email going throughout the United States to let everybody know that in the state of Texas, there's an individual down there who's willing to stand up for what we believe in.
And then that's going to have an influence on the party under the party banner under which you're running. And then that party is going to take your candidacy into greater consideration, saying, wait a minute, this guy has a lot of support, so therefore we want to support him. Is that correct?
Exactly. And that's unfortunately the political process, because, you know, they're going to be reluctant. I don't know how many times I've blogged on either CQ Congressional Quarterly or in the San Antonio Express News or the Austin Statesman or even Politico. You know, they continue to list all the other Republican candidates who are running, but they never list me. And I'm saying, you know, I've been running for a year and a half, and you keep on leaving me off the doggone list only because you only want these other individuals. Because I kind of looked at it this way. The political party, to unfortunately to some degree, has become a monarchy. And what I mean by that is basically you had to go through all these levels and have all these titles in order to get to the very top.
How interesting concept.
So, and then all of a sudden you have somebody like King Arthur comes along and says, now that he's a peasant, and yet he's still trying to make a stand, and it throws them all off. Say, well, hold on, we don't want you, because you've not been groomed, and you have not been bred to be one of us. You know, because you have to go through all these programs and hold these positions before we consider you, you know, one of us. And I'm saying, you know what? I don't care. I want to be an American first and a party second.
And maybe going through all those programs is not the best thing for the country either. So I think what a wonderful concept, and I haven't heard anybody else use that, is the political party system has become like a monarchy.
Yeah, pretty much. You have those that are at the top.
I like that.
And they control, and, you know, you got your nobles and you got your dukes, and they all have different titles at different positions, and you work your way up, and then they have their conventions and pretty much, you know, elect the person that they want to go ahead and put there based upon, you know, what they've contributed to the party. And it doesn't make a difference, you know, which party, when reality is it's about the American people, and that's what this last election was about. The American people say, you know what, we're kind of tired of the party process. We want somebody to represent the people. And
I like what you say with the monarchy, because then it's just the distribution of titles. And
exactly.
If you're in line for the title, if you came from the right line and you're in line for the title, you get the prize. You get the office. And I love that concept.
And once again,
Cass, when I first met him, about how he became a nominee for, you know, senator, you know, on the Republican ticket, you know, how that worked. Because, you know, that's what I thought. I thought the Republicans kind of nominated somebody. And, you know, you explained, Cass, to me that it doesn't work like that, that anybody can basically run. But, yeah, that's actually what I thought. I mean, we didn't use the word monarchy, but that's what I thought. I mean, that's how it looks like it works from this end. You know, if you're not involved.
Well, this is how John McCain got to where he was going. It was his turn, you know. And I think he's a fine man, and he's a real hero. But you don't get the nomination because it's your turn, because then you don't have a real chance of winning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know?
And the same thing happens in the Democratic Party, and that's why you have so many independents in the middle who sway the outcome of any election, because, you know, they say, we're kind of both. You know, we're in the middle of the road. We're kind of like the Reaganites.
Exactly. Hillary Clinton, it was her turn. You know, that's what she thought. It was her turn. So, yes, I see what you're saying. Of course, I don't have much use for Hillary Clinton. I think John McCain is a fine man. But, well, that's the difference, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but put John McCain up against Barack Obama, and, you know, come on, you know.
I
think if they put Palin up in 2012, you know, I think she's got a shot, but she's got to get that nomination, and she's saying she doesn't even want to run, but then it looks like she is, so nobody knows.
Hmm.
Well, there are a lot of factors involved with Palin, so I guess everybody is just going to have to wait and see with her. Personally, I like her. I think a lot of women are jealous of her. I think she's, and I'll say this, I don't care who knows it. I mean, the difference with women and these two candidates, because women and men, whether we like it or not, think differently. And
mm-hmm.
Hillary Clinton is just butt ugly, and Sarah Palin just keeps butt.
I think Clinton's out of it because she can't even stand up straight anymore. She keeps tripping and falling down. So,
and
I think we have to worry about 2012.
You know,
I honestly think
there's a lot of jealousy
there.
Of Palin.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to let you all go, Cass. It's been wonderful talking to you. I think we've covered some wonderful points. You think the Electoral College is really a balance and that ethnicity and culture need to be retained, because for one thing, if you do it, it's going to help the business world, but
mm-hmm.
you still have to assimilate into the American culture, become an American, and then allow your ethnicity and your culture to help develop the country but still become an American to contribute to national unity. And then our electoral college system really does prevent, it should prevent anyway, someone from being able just to select specific areas and take that vote to heck with the rest of the country, such as you, thank God, you're saying, take us Wicket and Monahan. You're a little bitty town. I mean, you go through Wicket and you blink your eyes, and before you, your eyes open up again, it's gone. You know, but I mean, the people there are still important. It's less populated, but West Texas is still an important area. You could focus on Harris County, but they're important too, but not any more important than West Texas.
Exactly.
Well, Cass, I want to thank you so much.
And if anybody doesn't understand anything that we talked about tonight as far as authenticity and demographics, just go watch some old reruns of Archie Bunker on All in the Family, and you'll completely understand.
Okay. On that note, meathead.
Okay, you guys, both of you behave yourselves. Don't stick any drugs up your butt, and we'll see you next Thursday, okay?
All right, Dolly.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Mike, thanks a lot, dude.
All right, bye-bye. Okay. All right, everybody, that was Andrew Castanuela, running for Senator of Texas in 2012, and, of course, our co-host, Dolly Miller Brennan. All right, everybody, this is MJH. Peace, God bless, and I'm out of here. Later.
You have been listening to the MJH Experience on Blog Talk Radio.
Produced by CommunicationCreations.com.